You're listening to Regulatory Fishing, a podcast series brought to you by Holland & Knight and hosted by government contracts and cybersecurity attorney Eric Kruchas. This series will analyze the latest cybersecurity news for the government contracting industry, from reviewing the Department of Defense and how national security shapes cybersecurity requirements to insights from industry leaders on the ever-changing landscape of cybersecurity. This podcast will help government contracting professionals hack into the latest cybersecurity developments around the world.
Hi, this is Eric Kruchas. Welcome to the latest episode of Regulatory Fishing. Today, we're going to talk about something interesting, a Department of Justice lawsuit that was brought under the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative. With me is Kelsey Hayes, an attorney in our government contracts group. Hello, Kelsey.
Hi.
I have to give Kelsey a lot of credit. She was the one who spearheaded a blog post that we wrote about this. So if you do see the blog, just note that a lot of that is Kelsey's handiwork. So Kelsey, appreciate that, first of all. This case is really interesting, I thought, because first, it's kind of the first time that the Department of Justice really talked about in such gruesome detail what they expect contractors to do under the various different Department of Defense regulatory requirements. In our title of the blog, mentions the Civil Cyber Fraud Initiative, which came out more than 2 years ago now, and required contractors to abide by certain cybersecurity standards. And really, the initiative is the DOJ kind of taking a closer look at contractors, making sure they comply with those standards across the Department of Defense specifically. And this is the latest kind of in a long line of things that the government has done to kind of bring to bear these cyber requirements onto contractors and make sure they're protecting information. So we thought today we'd kind of talk a little bit about this new case that was brought first. This was initially brought as a whistleblower lawsuit. I wonder if you could just kind of explain to everybody what a whistleblower lawsuit is.
Yeah, so a whistleblower lawsuit is an action that's brought under a provision of the False Claims Act that allows private litigants, just regular everyday people, to bring a lawsuit against a contractor or another entity in the name of the United States government, where, you know, they're basically acting, you know, in the government's interest, so to speak, to bring to light wrongdoings or noncompliances or whatnot. And so in this case, it was an action brought by a whistleblower, I think a former and possibly even a current employee of the research lab. So they, you know, had intimate knowledge of what their employer was doing and felt that it wasn't in compliance with the regulatory requirements and decided to utilize that provision of the FCA.
What I find a lot of times with these whistleblower complaints, and it seems like it may have happened here, where the whistleblower tried to make things right within the organization itself, and they weren't heard, so they took another action to either protect themselves or to kind of blow the whistle, so to speak. The interesting thing about this, so this was brought by the whistleblower some time ago, and the government has the option to intervene in these cases or not. If the Department of Justice decides to intervene, then they take control of the case. And here they did that, and then they filed a new complaint with all this other information they have. And I was struck in the complaint, just reading through it, with how much detail was in there on the different controls that weren't complied with and just all the kind of the background information, emails. They had emails between the parties internally. So all that kind of stuff was just pretty crazy. I wonder if you could kind of walk through some of the allegations in the complaint.
Sure. So the principal allegation is that a particular research lab within Georgia Tech was not in compliance with a contract provision in their DoD contracts, and that's DFARS 252-204-7012, which I'm sure your listeners of the podcast are familiar with. It's the primary DoD cybersecurity regulation. And the regulation requires contractors to provide adequate security on information systems that process, store, or transmit controlled unclassified information. And this was a clause that was included in the research lab's contracts. They had contracts with the Air Force and Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So basically, the clause requires you to provide the security, and that security is defined in terms of the controls specified in NIST Special Publication 800-171, which I'm sure your listeners are also very familiar with.
And if they're not, they can call us and we can explain it to them.
Yes. So NIST itself specifies, I think, 110 security controls that contractors need to have to protect CUI that is on their information systems. And the particular NIST controls that were raised in the, I believe, both the whistleblower's complaint and in DOJ's complaint were that the research lab failed to document and periodically update a system security plan, which is a NIST security control. And that they also failed to install, update, and run antivirus in incident detection software, which is part of a family of the NIST controls under 3.14. So to your point, the government, you know, was very specific, and, you know, they broke down the controls that the contractor was required to have on its information system through this DFARS clause, which incorporates this NIST publication. And because of the whistleblower, they had information that the research lab did not implement these controls, and therefore government controlled and classified information was at risk technically. So
really interesting. It's interesting how kind of granular DOJ got with this. Like, this control is unimplemented, this one. You know, we talked to a lot of clients. I know you and I both, where we kind of talked through the requirements of NIST 800-171. And I think one thing that was also really interesting here that I think a lot of companies miss is the lack of POAMs, plans of action and milestones. So it can be okay, and I'm not going to make a blanket statement that it always is, but it can be okay in certain circumstances to not have all the controls implemented if you have plans of action and milestones and have a plan to get into compliance with some of these controls. And that was one of the complaints, I think, in this complaint, that they didn't have those plans of action for those unimplemented controls.
Yeah. And I think that that's an important point to make, because it's not always clear from the face of the DFARS clause that you can have these POAMs. Even when I just read the DFARS clause at its face, it says adequate security is NIST 800-171. But it's really only, I think, once you get into the NIST document itself that talks about the system security plan in detail and the POAMs and sort of says that's where you understand you don't have to immediately have them all in place, but you can have a plan to get there. At least that was the case when the rule first came out in, what, 2016, when you had to have these controls in. So now in 2024, especially with CMC on the horizon, I think it's starting to be a different story. But yeah, that was definitely a big part of the allegation against the research lab.
One last thing I want to kind of touch on before we end this podcast is doesn't seem to be an allegation that there's any kind of security breach or anything, but that doesn't really matter to the government. They went on for a few pages that talked about that the lack of compliance of these security controls is something that's material, kind of hitting that element for the False Claims Act. They still have to prove that fact. This is just a complaint, of course. But your thoughts on that? That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's funny. When I first, you know, learned about the case being unsealed and about DOJ's intervention, my immediate thought was, wait, if there was no breach, if none of this, you know, CUI and the contractor's information systems hacked by an outside party or disclosed to someone that shouldn't have access to it, then what's the big deal? Like, what's the harm to the government? No one got their hands on this information that they, you know, that shouldn't have. And that's where materiality comes in. And, you know, I momentarily forgot about that when I was reading this, but materiality is something under the FCA. So in order for a false claim to be actionable under the FCA, the false claim has to be material to the government's payment decision under the contract. And DOD and DOJ have made very clear that cybersecurity is of utmost importance. The DOJ spent much of their brief or complaint and intervention, as you mentioned, describing how material and how important DOD cybersecurity regulations are, and really made the case that these terms are material to compliance and to the government's decision to pay. And in fact, there was an earlier case in 2019 where it was brought, you know, similar action brought under DFARS 7012. And the relator was alleging, you know, noncompliance with 7012, and the contractor tried to move to dismiss, saying, hey, this isn't material. You can't show that this is material. And that case was notable because it was the first time that a court said, you know, yes, you know, we were at least in this instance, the relator has sufficiently alleged materiality for 7012. So we're going to let it proceed. So we have that case, and then we have that decision. And now we have this case where we see the DOJ spending pages and pages of its complaint really bolstering that materiality argument. And like you said, it's just a complaint. It'll have to, you know, go through the ringer, but it is really interesting at this stage. And I think it sends a big message.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And the big message is a great point, because this is one of the first times we've seen kind of Department of Justice's view on these things. And my guess is that there are thousands of contractors that are in the same position as the universities here. So puts a lot of folks at risk who are not paying attention to these requirements. And I think it's a good lesson, without having to pay the price, for a lot of those contractors to look at this complaint and say, okay, what did DOJ say was wrong here? And are we doing those things? And if we are doing those things, we need to fix them right away.
Yeah. And to the point earlier when we were discussing, what a whistleblower case is, what a key tam action is, under that provision, whistleblower is actually entitled to a share in the government's recovery if they win the case. So all this to say is that people in your organization, might have an incentive to sort of go against your company if they think that the company's not in compliance, because it could result in a big payout for them. It's a tool that the government uses to, get its job done. And it's something that contractors should be aware of, because as we see in the Georgia Tech case, relators are a very real thing, and they'll, take advantage of that provision and bring these complaints on behalf of the government.
Great way to end. Thank you, Kelsey, for being with us today.
Awesome. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for listening. We're certainly going to have more podcasts on this topic because I think the False Claims Act is something that's going to be very real for this community. And it just seems like Department of Justice is really ramping up its efforts here. So we'll continue to focus on this topic and please stay tuned for the next one. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Regulatory Phishing. For more information on the topics covered in today's episode, please email eric.crucius@hklaw.com or visit hklaw.com/cybersecurity.